Just want to give a shout out to our latest patrons. Thank you so much for signing up on Patreon, donating either $2 or $5 US per month. Kira Buskies, Laurie Bennett, Lauren Darling, Erin Louise, Jody Houghton, Sri Paul, Craig Smith, Brendan Smith. I don't know if you guys are related, but thank you. Asigul Baba, Kendi Lawrence, Steph, Fiona Hill, Kelsey McFarlane, Rachel Tucker, Sunley Gadpins, Ruby the Sausage, that's an interesting name, Amanda Beamsley, Matthew Riley, Megan Pierce, and Margaret Smee. Thank you so much for your support.
Please be advised this podcast contains descriptions of graphic violence and is not appropriate for children.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. Come with us as we go beyond the news cycle to find out how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next. The disappearance of Stephen Lapthorne and Michelle Pope in Sydney has been unsolved for almost 41 years. Craig Foskett is an old mate of Stephen's and part of a group known as the Tarramurra Old Boys, who've decided it's now or never to find some evidence that could lead to answers about what happened to Stephen and Michelle. And they believe the answer lies in finding the remains of Stephen's vehicle, a distinctive green Bedford van.
We're former students of Tarramurra High School, where Stephen went to school. We've kept in contact over the years. We used to play sports together under the name of Tarramurra Old Boys and that sort of thing. And the Stephen and Michelle case, you know, occasionally cropped up in conversation. When they went missing initially, a couple of our friends went searching virtually the day after they were reported missing. And one of them even went to the extent of hiring a small plane with a friend and flying over Kringlay Chase National Park, but to no avail, unfortunately. Yeah, as time passed, hopes faded, I guess, and activity sort of came to a halt in the case. And it was just some years ago that a group of us just came up in conversation again, and we thought, well, let's make a fresh start at this. Let's try and rekindle some interest. If we don't do it now, we never will, sort of thing, being in our 60s and most of us being retired. So.
Yeah, and it's 40 years, so I find that quite an incredible feat to hire a light plane to go over this national park. We're recording here from Melbourne, and right. A lot of our listeners are all over the world and around Australia. Can you describe to us the area where Stephen and Michelle went missing and sure. Just set the scene for us?
So we're talking Sydney, and we're talking the northern suburbs of Sydney, about 16 kilometres from the CBD perhaps. A place called West Pymble is where Stephen was living with his parents, and his girlfriend was further north in a suburb called Barara, which is in the Hornsby Shire. From West Pymble to Barara, it's probably about a 20-minute drive. Back in that day, yeah, probably a little bit quicker I would expect, but that's pretty much the landscape of the area. It's I'd call it, generally speaking, a middle-class area. There are some very wealthy people in certain areas around Pymble and Wurunga and places like that. But, yeah, we were all pretty much middle-class sort of guys.
And so the day that Stephen and Michelle went missing, Stephen went to pick up Michelle?
No, there was a party at Stephen's place for his sister's birthday. And Michelle attended the party with him. There was probably about 20 people there, a bit hazy on the numbers, but a member of our group was at the party at the time, but he can't recall the exact numbers. But there was a party for his sister's birthday, and Stephen had planned to go skiing with some of his workmates. He worked at Otis Elevators. So he was going to drive Michelle home to her mother's house in Barara, and then he was going to pick up some workmates and head down to the snow for a few days of skiing. So he left the party at about 10:15 p.m. to drive to Barara. So, yeah, it should have taken about 20 or 30 minutes to get to Michelle's place. But, yeah, unfortunately, they never arrived, and they've never been seen again, and the van, the green Bedford van that Stephen was driving, has never been found. So it's a complete mystery.
I was struck by how distinctive that car is. Now, I don't know a lot about vehicles, but it was a Bedford van. It was lime or bright green, you'd describe it as, and very distinctive.
That's another thing, strange thing about this case. There's no actual picture of the van. They're all sort of like likely lookalike vans.
Yep.
There was no record of a photo of the actual van of Stephen.
Were there any other unusual features beside the colour of the van? Did it have stickers on it or anything? Or
yeah, it had something on the back, like a waving hand or something. But it had a green stripe down the side. He had mag wheels. He had a CB radio as well. He was a bit of a CB radio enthusiast. So there was an aerial on top.
So that is, do you think, a key to this case? I know certainly you told me that you and your friends have been looking for that van still to this day. What do you think happened to it?
Well, nobody knows for sure, but our hypothesis is that they stopped somewhere along the way, either to buy something or to maybe go parking and be a little bit romantic. Michelle had to be home by 11, as I understand it. That was kind of the curfew. She had a job interview the next day, actually, so she needed to be home reasonably early for a Friday night. We think the most likely scenario is that they'd stopped and they were approached by someone when they were stopped. Maybe the intention was just as a robbery or something like that, but maybe Stephen challenged the person and it got out of hand and things went horribly wrong is quite a possibility. Maybe he reached for his CB radio to make a distress call and that's when things turned nasty. But who knows? But just getting back to the van, the fact that it's never been found, there were about 170 sightings of the van, as I understand it, in the days or the weeks following their disappearances. And that was, from northern New South Wales down to Goulburn and everywhere, basically. So the reports of the sightings are not all that helpful, I don't think, to the police, because there were just too many and there was nothing that they could really go on. We think the most likely scenario is that they were approached while parking. Things went horribly wrong and the perpetrator probably dumped the van somewhere in the Hornsby area.
Now, you told me that the Hornsby area was a bit of a hotspot for vehicle dumping and destruction. So where would they have dumped it? What would they have done with it?
Well, there were certain places that seemed to be popular dumping grounds. There's a place called Mount Coringa Industrial Park, which is also in the Hornsby Shire, which is an area that we've been very interested in. And we found a number of car bodies in our expeditions into the bush. Unfortunately, not the one we're looking for. But we think, it's more likely to have been a local job, for want of a better word. And there's a reason also behind that, Emily, is the report in the Daily Mirror a few months after they went missing of the mystery man.
Yeah, you showed me that article. We'll try and share that with our listeners when we put this podcast out. Tell us about this sighting, because really there has been very, very little, hasn't there, in good evidence or good leads about this case.
That's what makes this case so difficult. There's absolutely no evidence. The police have never named a specific person of interest. So it's quite unusual to the extent that there's absolutely no evidence and no leads or no understanding of what happened. Yeah, so just getting back to the mystery man, about 3 months after the disappearances, Mrs. Lapthorne gave an interview to the Daily Mirror newspaper, and she had been advised by the police not to mention it to the media because they thought her description of this mystery man was too vague. But anyway, at about 7:30 on the Saturday morning, they disappeared on the Friday night, so they hadn't been reported to police at this stage. About 7:30 the next morning, on the Saturday morning, Mrs. Lapthorne heard a car pull up in front of the house, and she looked out, and there was a man driving a light blue Datsun or something similar. He stopped in front of the house, had a look at the house, and then he swung over to the other side of the road and checked out the house from there for about a minute and then took off. So Mrs. Lapthorne's interpretation of that was that that was the perpetrator, that he had Stephen's wallet and found his address and had come to check out the house, potentially to rob or something like that, I would think. Yeah, but as I said, the police had advised Mrs. Lapthorne not to mention that to the media. But out of frustration and lack of progress in the case, I guess she just decided to go against that advice and talk to the media. So, there was an article appearing about the mystery man. The description was vague. Obviously didn't get a number plate or anything like that. It's of specific interest to us, who was the mystery man. And that sort of supports our hypothesis that the dumping was local, because if the event occurred around about 11 p.m. or midnight, you're not going to drive the van to northern New South Wales or down to Goulburn and be back in West Pimble at 7:30 the next morning.
No. And I know from doing a lot of research into cases over the years for some of the stuff I've written about, you know, it wasn't unusual back in those days for people to go parking in secluded spots, but also there has been other cases of people, you know, murdered, surprised by either someone wanting to rob them or just a thrill killer who surprised couples in their vans. But what do you remember of that time with, you know, just you and your mates trying to help with the search and, I guess, the media around it and the police investigation?
Yeah, well, I wasn't directly involved, particularly at that point in time. There was a couple of other members or friends of ours that are part of the group that still continues to investigate. On the Saturday morning, one of the friends received a phone call from the sister asking if he'd seen Stephen, and of course he hadn't. Yeah, so they pretty much started searching immediately from there. In fact, the night they went missing, when Stephen didn't turn up to pick up his friends to go skiing, they jumped in the car about 2 or 3 a.m. in the morning and took the road up to Barara to see if they could see any evidence of accidents or anything like that. But that also came up as nothing. There were, you know, bush expeditions into the bush, down fire trails and that sort of thing. As I mentioned, you know, there were air searches and yeah, but just over time, things sort of fell away a bit, I guess.
Yeah, it's very sad for the families because Stephen's father's still alive, is that correct?
I believe so, yes.
And what about Michelle's family? What do you know of that situation?
Well, she lived with her mother only. I think her parents were divorced. My understanding is her mother is now in a nursing home. Hopefully she's still alive. Yeah, I'm not too sure on that side, but Mrs. Lapthorne has passed away, unfortunately. Yeah, I guess that's the tragedy, you know, we're coming up to 41 years this year and they've never really been able to celebrate a Christmas, I expect.
Yeah, no answers, and they were so young. Michelle and Stephen were just so young.
Yeah, that's right. I think maybe initially there was a mindset, oh, you know, they've eloped or something like that, but we discounted that pretty quickly. It was just too out of character for the Stephen that we knew.
So tell me about what kind of person Stephen was and also what you knew of Michelle.
I never met Michelle. And, yeah, I wasn't all that close to Stephen. I was a year below, but other friends of mine were in the same year and two of them particularly were very close to him. But he was just an ordinary guy. He loved his vehicles and loved going out, you know, for weekends away and camping and staying in the back of the van and that sort of thing. We were all pretty carefree back in the late 70s.
I was born in the late 70s, so I can't remember it. But, I mean, it was seemed like a pretty decent time to sort of be young and going about your life.
Yeah, well, that's right. We didn't have random breath testing back in the day, so we used to do some silly things, you know. But, yeah, it was all pretty hedonistic sort of lifestyle. Didn't have too much to worry about. Stephen had a job, so he had some money to spend. And, yeah, I think it was just an ordinary guy having a good time.
I was doing a little bit of reading. Michelle was doing her HSC and Stephen was very supportive of that from what I read. There was obviously the age difference with them, but I guess everyone moves on with their lives and they, you know, move on and you've moved to Hobart. At what point did you reconnect with some of these guys and say, let's try and do something?
Well, yeah, we've pretty much kept together since high school days, mostly through email. We have a Facebook group and that sort of thing. But yeah, we occasionally get together for reunions, and usually in Sydney, you know, might get 20 or 30 of us, although the group that's interested in this case is probably about 10. Yeah, and it just comes up in conversation occasionally. And just maybe the last time it came up in conversation, I think actually the conversation started with talk about Ivan Milat, and then someone might have mentioned, oh, you know, he was probably responsible for Stephen and Michelle's disappearance, and started talking about that, and it kind of snowballed from there, I guess.
Now, Ivan Milat's name does come up a lot when we think about and talk about cases of missing and murdered people of that kind of time, and it's probably wasn't such a bad thought to think that Ivan Milat could have been responsible, but you've done a little bit of research in that and spoken to a few people who were very involved in the Milat case, haven't you?
Yeah, we were fortunate to get in contact with Clive Small, a former detective who pretty much busted Malat. And his advice to us was, no, it was not Malat. He gave us a number of reasons why. Predominantly didn't fit his pattern of criminal behaviour. No evidence that he was ever in the Hornsby area. And at that time, in 1978, he wasn't his unstable self. But there are other reasons, and Clive's on record elsewhere of what those reasons are. Yeah, but initially, Malat gets blamed for everything, basically. And we initially started investigating Malat, you know, where he was living at the time and working and all that sort of stuff. And as I said, we couldn't come up with any connection to the Hornsby area. And then following Clive's advice, he said, okay, well, we'll heed Clive's advice and assume it's not Malat. And then, okay, let's consider what other possible perpetrators there might have been, what type of criminal it might have been. And, we moved on from Malat, basically.
If you're finding this episode interesting, you might like episode number 54, Who Killed My Sister? The Cold Case of Fiona Burns and John Lee. After the break, Craig talks about the kind of person who could be responsible for the disappearance and presumed murder of Stephen and Michelle. Coming up on Australian True Crime, Craig talks about the searches he and the Tarramurra Old Boys conduct in the rugged terrain of Sydney's Hornsby area.
Our concentration is on finding the van. We're not all that sort of dedicated to trying to suppose who the perpetrator might have been, except for the fact that we tried to kind of understand what kind of perpetrator it was, what the motive might have been. Was it someone acting alone, or was it more than one person? And we came to the conclusion it was probably one person acting alone. The motive was robbery. Yeah, so it's pretty obvious now that the police are not going to make any further efforts in the case unless they get new information or some evidence is found. We don't have any new information to provide the police at this point. Our efforts are more focused on finding some evidence. And it's much harder to find evidence of the bodies than it would be to find evidence of a Bing Green Bedford van. So that's where our concentration is, where our focus is on trying to find some evidence of where the van was dumped, because we assume it was dumped and burnt out on the night of the 25th of August, 1978.
Yeah, I was looking at pictures of those vans. They're big vans. They're not like a little small car.
No, that's right.
How have you been searching for this van? Have you been also like looking into car clubs or car enthusiasts?
We do have a contact in England who is a specialist on Bedford vans. What we do, we study maps. We were fortunate to get some maps of the late 70s of the area. And we don't just walk down fire trails. We try to identify places where it was possible to dump a vehicle, so close to a road, a ravine close to a road, and not far from a population centre. Because if you're going to dump a car, you don't want to have to walk 5 kilometres back to town. You probably only travel a kilometre or two maximum. So we study the maps. We look for deep ravines where there's a possible access from a road. And most of those places, we don't concentrate so much on Ku'ringai Chase National Park because we think that's been searched fairly extensively. That was the main area of search by the police and others. And the national park is fairly well maintained by the authorities. Our efforts are more directed further west of the highway, of the Pacific Highway, not on the eastern side of the Pacific Highway, because, as I mentioned before, there's a place called Mount Ku'ringai Industrial Park. And now that didn't exist in 1978. It was a bit of a place kind of like a shanty town, actually. There was a lot of illegal structures and sort of transients living there and that sort of thing. But it was also a place where young people went drag racing at night time and that sort of thing. And it was also a place where people went parking at night. Albeit it was a very probably the most unsafest place you could choose in that area. So there were several places that we identified as being possible parking places for couples. But given the fact there was a time constraint that Stephen had to have Michelle home by 11, he probably wouldn't have ventured down to the place called Bobbin Head, which is popular. There was another one called Berry Park. We've searched around that as well. But our particular area of interest, I think, is the Mount Coringai Industrial Park. And we've done some searches there, but we're probably only about halfway through the places we want to have a look at.
Could the car have been offloaded and then sold on or moved on, do you think? Is that a possibility?
Yeah, you can never say never. But if that's the case, then it has to go through the hands of other people. So that means that given the publicity around the case, you know, initially after their disappearances, you think if somebody came across a car trying to be offloaded or Bedford parts and that sort of thing, someone would have clicked. So you can't say no, that it wasn't recycled, but we think the likelihood of it just being dumped and burnt is higher than that.
So I know we've talked about a few other things, Craig. Are you willing to go a little bit into the theory about someone you would like to know more information about their life in the 1970s and their movements? Is that something you want to touch on?
Yes, we can. I mean, when we first started rekindling our interest, one of the group members sent us some material on a chap by the name of Ashley Coulston and said, you guys should read this. If our hypothesis is correct, then this sort of criminal, you know, commits that sort of crime. So, we started looking into Ashley Coulston. Actually, the article that he distributed to us, I think, was written by you, Emily.
I think it was from the Herald Sun. It was I'd written a chapter in my first book,
Murder
in Suburbia. I remember.
It was that chapter.
Yeah, I did a fair bit of research, but I mean, there's always room to get more information. So hopefully, when I update the books, I can get more. But yeah. I know that for listeners, particularly if you're from Victoria, the name Ashley Coulston will be familiar because he committed the triple murder in Burwood of the two students and their brother-in-law. It was quite horrific. And to this day, there's been Coulston has never, ever given a reason for what he did. He was caught really in the process of almost doing the same to another couple in the city in Melbourne. So you'd really like to know more about Coulston's movements in the 1970s as he was around New South Wales?
In 1978, at the time of Stephen and Michelle's disappearances, Coulston was living in Kyogle in northern New South Wales. We think he moved there in 1974. That's when his father bought a dairy farm up there. In 1978, he was in Kyogle. We have absolutely no evidence that he had any relationship to the Hornsby area. We just can't find very much, actually, about his past, apart from the fact that he lived in Victoria at Tamgambalanga, I think the place was called, and committed a crime at the age of 14 and spent some time in Tirana Youth Training Centre. So that was 1971. His father bought the farm in 74. So between 71 and 74, there's a gap. I've got no idea where he was at that time, whether he moved back to Tamgambalanga, which I think probably would have been very difficult for him, given the fact the Coulsons are a big family name down there, and he'd committed a fairly serious crime, attempting to kidnap two school teachers. Not attempting, he actually did kidnap
school
teachers. Just out of interest mainly, did he have any connection to the Hornsby area? Could he have known the Hornsby area well for some reason? Because, we think that the person who perpetrated the crime was either very lucky if they dumped the car or knew the area well and knew where to dump the car.
That's right. And I guess if anyone's listening who, you know, this is one of the main reasons we're talking to you, Craig, someone may know something, and you're certainly right. Coulston was 14 when in 1971 he had watched the movements of these two school teachers who were both 22 and abducted them. And, I mean, you know, he's a young guy to be doing something like that, and then went to Tirana, which was a boys' training home, I guess juvenile correctional facility, and then was in there for a number of months when I read some court documents. to do with his conviction for the Burwood triple killings, the judge actually said that the records couldn't be found of Coulston's time in Turana. And of course, I want to name the victims, Karen Henstridge, Anne Smurden and Peter Dempsey, is who he murdered in Burwood in 1992. That's a crime that a lot of Victorians will remember. But yeah, it would be great to know if anyone listening could help you out with anything about that.
Yeah, it's a bit of an enigma, really. Yeah, I spoke with Mick Stefanovic, the former detective who got involved in the Coulston case during the Burwood triple murders. And I just asked him about Coulston's past and that sort of thing. He didn't know much about Stephen and Michelle's disappearances, but that's fine. But he said, you know, it's certainly within his capability, that sort of crime. And Mick's conclusion was that if it was Coulston or a person of that criminal mindset, then the vehicle wouldn't have been of much value to them. That's not the reason for the perpetration of that sort of crime. It comes from, yeah, in different senses, if you like. So he said that it's more likely the van was burnt out and dumped.
Now, a young woman called Trudy Adams disappeared in 1978 as well, and she was in New South Wales, and the ABC did a podcast about that recently called Unravel. Have you done a bit of research into Trudy's disappearance?
Oh, I certainly watched that ABC documentary on it. At least in that case, there is a person, or was a person of interest, now deceased. Yeah, but once again, no evidence was found. But we can't see a connection between that case and this one.
Why is that?
They tended to pick up hitchhikers. Stephen and Michelle were not hitchhiking. They had their own vehicle. Yeah, it just doesn't seem to fit the person that is of most interest in the Trudy Adams case. And, yeah, it's a different area, the northern beaches of Sydney. It's different to Hornsby. They're probably more concentrated on the northern beaches area rather than the Hornsby area. We think it was someone different, someone who knew Hornsby pretty well.
Are you and the other guys that you're doing this with, are you fairly private about what you're doing, or are you starting to reach out a bit more to get some answers?
Yeah, no, we're more private now, definitely. We've just come to the conclusion that we have to find some evidence, otherwise we've got nothing. Otherwise it's just conjecture, and you can talk about possible perpetrators till you're blue in the face, but it's not going to change anything. It's not going to get a result for the parents who are still alive.
Are their siblings still alive?
As far as I know.
And so for you, how often do you do the trips back to Sydney to do the searches?
We've got another search coming up in about a month's time. So, yeah, I visit Sydney fairly regularly, but every time I go up we put a day aside to get a few of us together, and we because we plan it a bit beforehand, obviously. We say, okay, well, this is the place we're going to do next, and this is the place we're going to do after that. So we don't have a set time frame. We just, when the planets align, basically we get together and we spend a day bush bashing. Yeah, it's not just walking down fire trails. This is getting down to the bottom of steep ravines. And fortunately, one of the members of our group is a very good bushman. He has a really good sense of where we are and all that sort of stuff. So thankfully, to this point in time, we haven't gotten anyone lost or injured. So
yeah, it sounds quite strategic what you're doing.
We don't sort of explore vast areas. We just concentrate on particular areas that we think might have a probability of being a car dumping ground. And all the areas we've been to, we've found car bodies. Pretty easy to push a car off a cliff. There's a lot of rubbish, car bodies and all sorts of stuff in the bush in the Hornsby area, away from the national park. It's just ridiculous. Just from an environmental point of view, it's just, yeah, been educational.
Do you go with a sense of anticipation each time? Do you sort of have your heart thumping in your chest when you're looking at the car bodies?
It's always interesting to find a dump car body. Like, we're talking something that's 40 years old, so it's just going to be a rusted heap, basically, probably not even recognisable as a Bedford van. Yeah, so we take photos, we, you know, jot down all the GPS details and that sort of thing. We've got to keep a record of all our finds. Anything we think could possibly be apart from a Bedford van, we send off to a guy in England, and he comes back, and to this point in time, he said no. No. But hopefully at one point we'll be able to send him a photo and he might say, yeah, that could possibly be a Bedford van part or something. Yeah, we'll just keep plugging away until we've exhausted the areas that we've got sort of in our sights, I guess.
And is there anything you would appeal to the people listening to the podcast? Is there any help? Is there anything you need from people or they could assist further with the investigation?
Probably not, Emily, to be honest, unless they've got some information.
Yeah, so it's information you want. You want to know if anyone happened to know something. Often we've found on this podcast that sometimes people, they might know something and not speak at the time, but with the passage of time,
things change. We can only try and hopefully jog a memory or two. We're kind of at the conclusion that there's only two ways we'll get a better understanding of what happened on that night. And that's one, by someone coming forward with information or a confession, or two, finding some evidence. So we're concentrating on the second part. But if there's someone out there who has some information, and by all means, don't hesitate, call Crime Stoppers or do whatever you think you need to do. But, don't hold back.
I just think when, you know, we were corresponding with each other, I think just the dedication to finding a mate, I think that's a story in itself. But yeah, if we get passed on the information, we will send it through to you. But we've got listeners all over the world, so you never know. Is there a sense of sadness for you? What is the feeling for you about Stephen and Michelle's disappearance?
Frustration to some extent, just with the lack of facts and evidence in this case. But, yeah, it's just also sympathy for the parents particularly and the other family members. I mean, siblings have a tendency to move on from tragedies. Parents never do. Yeah, it shouldn't happen, really, that someone has to live, you know, the rest of their lives for 40 years and having this big question mark just hanging out like a cloud over their heads. It must be inconceivable, basically. Only the people who have experienced it can understand, I think.
That's right. Thank you for talking to us. Is there anything that I haven't covered that you would like to add or?
I might just jump back to Coulston just for one
moment,
Emily, if that's all right. We know at the moment he's doing three life sentences in Bar One Prison in Victoria.
That's right.
So he's life without parole, or LBOP as they call it.
He's never to be released, that's right.
But he is a prime suspect in a number of other crimes. And I think there's a bigger issue here is how do you get someone on life without parole who's destined to die in jail? How do you incentivize that person to perhaps talk about their past criminal activity for which they haven't been prosecuted?
It's a very good question because, well, as I mentioned before, to this day, he has never given any reason or any information about what he did in Burwood, why he did it, how he chose the people he was going to kill. So, yeah, you're right, though. How do you get someone to talk?
He's a prime suspect of balaclava rapes and murder, you know, the Gold Coast. And he's also a prime suspect of the Sutherland Shire rapist. He lived in both places, at the time those things were going on. So I'm not the only one. That's pretty common knowledge that he's a suspect in those areas. So how can you get him to fess up without violating his human rights? And the only way for a person in life without parole is to offer them some sort of incentive or privilege for the rest of their time in jail. He's never going to get out, that's for sure. And the families and the victims' families wouldn't tolerate that anyway. But is there some way that he can be encouraged? He certainly may not be related to the Stephen and Michelle's disappearances, but there's pretty strong argument that he's related in other bad happenings around the east coast of Australia. Does it all die with him or what?